This is cassette number 6.
Tears stung Kaylin's eyes as she looked out at the expanse of trees, the vibrant colors, the majestic mountains, and the huge sweep of blue sky dotted with fluffy white clouds marching off into the distance. The size of the mountains, their imposing slopes, their luscious color, was beyond anything she had ever encountered before. How could she possibly not have wanted more than anything to get up and see the world around her? "You know, of course, that you've made a big mistake," Richard said. "What do you mean?" Kaylin asked. "Well, had you not gotten up, we'd have kept waiting on you, at least for a time. Now that you've shown us that you can get up and move on your own, we're only going to keep doing this, putting things out of your reach to make you start moving about and helping yourself." While she silently thanked him, she was unwilling, just yet, to tell him out loud how right he had been. But inside she loved him all the more for braving her anger to help her. Kara turned to Richard. "Should we show her where she can find the table?" Richard shrugged. "If she gets hungry, she'll come out of the bedroom and find it." Kaylin threw the cup at him, hoping to wipe the smirk off his face. He caught the cup. "Well, glad to see your arm works," he said. "You can cut your own bread." When she started to protest, he said, "It's only fair. Kara baked it. The least you can do is to cut it." Kaylin's mouth fell open. "Kara baked bread?" "Lord Rahl taught me," Kara said. "I wanted bread with my stew. Real bread, and he told me that if I wanted bread, I would have to learn to make it. It was easy, really. A little like walking to the window, but I was much more good-natured about it and didn't throw anything at him." Kaylin could not help smiling. Knowing it must have been harder for Kara to knead dough than for Kaylin to get up and walk, she somehow doubted that Kara had been good-natured about it. Kaylin would like to have seen that battle of wills. "Give me back my cup, and then go catch some fish for dinner. I'm hungry. I want a trout, a big trout, along with bread." Richard smiled. "I can do that. If you can find the table." Kaylin did find the table. She never ate in bed again. At first, the pain of walking was sometimes more than she could tolerate, and she took refuge in her bed. Kara would come in and brush her hair, just so Kaylin wouldn't be alone. She had no power in her muscles, and could hardly move by herself. Brushing her own hair was a colossal task. Just getting to the table was exhausting, and all she could accomplish at first. Richard and Kara were sympathetic and continually encouraged her, but they pushed her, too. Kaylin was joyous to be out of bed, and that helped her to ignore the pain. The world was again a wondrous place. She was more than joyous to be able at last to go out to the privy. While she never said so, Kaylin was sure Kara was happy about that, too. As much as she liked the snug home, going outside felt like finally being freed from a dungeon. Before, Richard had frequently offered to take her outside for the day, but she had never wanted to leave her bed, fearing the pain. She realized that because she was so sick, her thinking had slowly become dull and foggy. Along with her summer, she had for a time lost herself. Now, at long last, she felt clear-headed. She discovered that the view outside her window was the least impressive of the surrounding sights. Snow-capped peaks towered around the small house Richard and Kara had built in the lap of breathtaking mountains, the simple house with a bedroom at either end, one for Richard and Kaylin and one for Kara, with a common room in the middle, sat at the edge of a meadow of velvety green grasses sprinkled with wildflowers. Even though it was late in the season when they had arrived, Richard managed to start a small garden in a sunny place outside Kara's window, growing fresh greens for the table and some herbs to add flavor to their cooking. Right behind the house, huge old white pines towered over them, sheltering them from the full force of the wind. Richard had continued his carving, to pass the time as he sat by Kaylin's bed, talking and telling stories, but after she had at last gotten out of bed, his carvings changed. Instead of animals, Richard began sculpting people. And then one day he surprised her with his most magnificent carving yet, in celebration, he said, of her getting well enough to finally come out into the world. Astonished by the utter realism and power of the small statue, she whispered that it could only be the gift that had guided his hand in carving it. Richard regarded such talk as nonsense. "People without the gift carve beautiful statues all the time," he said. "There's no magic involved." She knew, though, that some artists were gifted and able to invoke magic through their art. Richard occasionally spoke wistfully about the works of art he'd seen at the People's Palace in Dahara, where he had been held captive. Growing up in Heartland, he had never before seen statues carved in marble, and certainly none carved on such a grand scale, or by such talented hands. Those works had in some ways opened his eyes to the greater world around him, and had made a lasting impression on him. Who else but Richard would remember fondly the beauty he saw, while held captive and being tortured? It was true that art could exist independent of magic, but Richard had been taken captive in the first place only with the aid of a spell brought to life through art. Art was a universal language, and thus an invaluable tool for implementing magic. Kaylin finally stopped arguing with him about whether the gift helped him to carve. He simply didn't believe it. She felt, though, that having no other outlet, his gift must be expressing itself in this way. Magic always seemed to find a way to seep out, and his carvings of people certainly did seem magical to her. But the figure of the woman that he carved for her as a gift stirred profound emotion within her. He called it an image nearly 2 feet tall, carved from buttery, smooth, rich, aromatic walnut. Spirit. The femininity of her body, its exquisite shape and curves, bones and muscle, were clearly evident beneath her flowing robes. She looked alive. How Richard had accomplished such a feat, Kaylin couldn't even imagine. He had conveyed through the woman, her robes flowing in a wind as she stood with her head thrown back, her chest out, her hands fisted at her sides, her back arched and strong as if in opposition to an invisible power trying unsuccessfully to subdue her. A sense of spirit. The statue was obviously not intended to look like Kaylin, yet it evoked in her some visceral response, a tension that was startlingly familiar. Something about the woman in the carving, some quality it conveyed, made Kaylin hunger to be well, to be fully alive, to be strong and independent again. If this wasn't magic, she didn't know what was. Kaylin had been around grand palaces her whole life, exposed to any number of pieces of great art by renowned artists, but none had ever taken her breath with its thrust of inner vision, its sense of individual nobility as did this proud, vibrant woman in flowing robes. The strength and vitality of it brought a lump to Kaylin's throat, and she could only throw her arms around Richard's neck in speechless emotion. Chapter 19. Now Kaylin went outside at every opportunity. She placed the carving of spirit on the windowsill so she could see it not only from bed but also when she was outdoors. She turned the statue so that it always faced outside. She felt it should always be facing the world. The woods around the house were mysterious and alluring. Intriguing trails went off into the shadowy distance, and she could just detect light off at the end of the gently curving tunnel through the trees. She ached to explore those narrow tracks, animal trails enlarged by Richard and Kara on their short treks to 10 fishing lines and forays in search of nuts and berries. Kaylin, with the aid of a staff, hobbled around the house and the meadow to strengthen her legs. She wanted to go with Richard on those treks, through the filtered sunlight and gentle breezes, over the open patches of ledge and under the arched, enclosing limbs of huge oaks. One of the first places Richard took her when she insisted she could walk for a short distance was through that tunnel in the thick, dark wood to the patch of light at the other end, where a brook descended a rocky gorge. The brook was sheltered on the hillside above them by a dense stand of trees. An enormous weight of water continuously plunged over that stepped tumble of rocks, surging around boulders and pouring in glassy sheets over ledges. Many of the bear-sized rocks sitting in the shady pools were flocked in a dark green velvet of moss and sprinkled with long tawny needles from the white pines that favor the rock slope. Flecks of sunlight, winking through the dense canopy, shimmered in the clear pools. At the bottom of that gorge, in that sunny mountain glen off behind their house, where the trail emerged from the woods, the brook broadened and slowed as it meandered through the expansive valley surrounded by the awesome jut of the mountains. Sometimes Kaylin would dangle her bony legs over a bank and let the cool water caress her feet. There she could sit on the warm grass and soak up the sun while watching fish swim through the crystal-clear water flowing over gravel beds. Richard had been right when he told her that trout liked beautiful places. She loved watching the fish, frogs, crayfish, and even the salamanders. Oftentimes she would lie in her stomach on the low, grassy bank, with her chin resting on the backs of her hands, and watch for hours as the fish came out from under sunken logs, from beneath rocks, or from the dark depths of larger pools to snatch a bug from the surface of the water. Kaylin caught crickets, grasshoppers, and grubs, and periodically tossed them in for the fish. Richard laughed when she talked to the fish, encouraging them to come up out of their dark holes for a tasty bug. Sometimes a graceful gray heron would stand on its thin legs in the shallow marshes not far away, and occasionally spear a fish or a frog with its dagger-like bill. Kaylin could not recall in the whole of her life ever being in a place with such a vibrancy of life to it, surrounded by such majesty. Richard teased her, telling her she hadn't seen anything yet, making her curious and ever eager to get stronger so she could explore new sights. She felt like a little girl in a magical kingdom that was theirs and theirs alone. Having grown up a confessor, Kaylin had never spent much time outdoors watching animals or water tumbling down over rocks or clouds or sunsets. She had seen a great many magnificent things, but they were in the context of travel, cities, buildings, and people. She had never lingered in one place in the countryside to really soak it all in. Still, the thoughts in the back of her mind hounded her. She knew that she and Richard were needed elsewhere. They had responsibilities. Richard casually deflected the subject whenever she broached it. He had already explained his reasoning and believed he was doing what was right. They hadn't been visited by messengers for a very long time. That worry played on her mind, too, but Richard said that he couldn't allow himself to influence the army, so it was just as well that General Rybish had stopped sending reports. Besides, he said, it only needlessly endangered the messengers who made the journey. For the time being, Kaylin knew she needed to get better, and her isolated mountain life was making her stronger by the day, probably as nothing else could. Once they returned to the war, once she convinced him that they must return, this peaceful life would be but a cherished memory. She resolved to enjoy what she couldn't change while it lasted. Once, when it had been raining for a few days, and Kaylin was missing going out to the brook to watch the fish, Richard did the most unheard-of thing. He started bringing her fish in a jar. Buy a fish. Fish just for watching. After he'd cleaned an empty lamp oil jug and several wide-mouthed glass jars that had held preserves, herbs, and unguents for her injuries, along with other supplies he had purchased on their journey away from Andereth, he put some gravel in the bottom and filled them with water from the stream. He then caught some black-nosed dace minnows and put them in the glass containers. They were yellowish olive on top, speckled with black, with white bottoms, and a thick black line down each side. He even provided them with a bit of weed from the brook so that they could have a place to hide and feel safe. Kaylin was astonished when Richard brought home the first jar of live fish. She set the jars, eventually 4 jars and 1 jug in all, on the windowsill in the main room, besides several of Richard's smaller carvings. Richard, Kaelin, and Kara sat at the small wooden table when they ate and watched the marvel of fish living in a jar. "Just don't name them," Richard said, "because eventually they're going to die." What she had at first thought was an entirely daft idea became a center of fascination for her. Even Kara, who cited fish in a jar as lunacy, took a liking to the little fish. It seemed that every day with Richard in the mountains held some new marvel to turn her mind away from her own pains and troubles. After the fish became accustomed to people, they went about their little lives as if living in a jar were perfectly natural. From time to time, Richard would pour out part of their water and add fresh water from the brook. Kaelin and Kara fed the little fish crumbs of bread or tiny scraps from dinner, along with small bugs. The fish ate eagerly and spent most of their time pecking at the gravel on the bottom or swimming about looking out at the world. After a while, the fish learned when it was lunchtime. They would wiggle eagerly on the other side of the glass whenever anyone approached, like puppies happy to see their masters. The main room had a small fireplace Richard had built with clay from stream banks he'd formed into bricks and dried in the sun and then cooked in a fire. They had the table he'd made and chairs constructed of branches intertwined and lashed together. He'd woven the chair bottoms and backs from leathery inner bark. In the corner of the room was a wooden door over a deep root cellar. Against the back wall were simple shelves and a big cupboard full of supplies. They'd bought a lot of supplies along the way and carried them either in the carriage with Kaelin or strapped on the back and sides. For the last part of the journey, Richard and Kara had lugged everything in, since the carriage couldn't make it over narrow mountain passes where there were no roads. Richard had blazed the trail in. Kara had her own room opposite theirs. Once up and about, Kaelin was surprised to find that Kara had a collection of rocks. Kara bristled at the term collection and asserted that they were there as defensive weapons should they be attacked and trapped in the house. Kaelin found the rocks all different colors, suspiciously pretty. Kara insisted they were deadly. While Kaelin had been bedridden, Richard had slept on a pallet in the main room, or sometimes outside under the stars. A number of times, at first, when she was in so much pain, Kaelin had awakened to see him sitting on the floor beside her bed, dozing as he leaned against the wall, always ready to jump up if she needed anything, or to offer her medicines and herb teas. He hadn't wanted to sleep in bed with her for fear of it hurting her. She almost would have been willing to endure it for the comfort of his presence beside her. Finally, though, after she was up and about, he was at last able to lie beside her. That first night with him in bed, she had held his big warm hand to her belly as she gazed at spirit silhouetted in the moonlight, listening to the night calls of birds, bugs, and the songs of wolves, until her eyes closed and she drifted into a peaceful slumber. It was on the next day that Richard first killed her. They were at the stream, checking the fishing lines, when he cut 2 straight willow switches. He tossed one in the ground beside where she sat and told her it was her sword. He seemed in a playful mood and told her to defend herself. Feeling playful herself, Kaelin took up the challenge by suddenly trying to stab him, just to put him in his place. He stabbed her first and declared her dead. She fought him again, more earnestly the second time, and he quickly dispatched her with a convincingly feigned beheading. By the third time she went after him, she was a little irked. She put all her effort into her assault, but he smoothly thwarted her attack and then pressed the tip of his willow-switch sword between her breasts. He announced her dead for the 3rd time out of 3. Thereafter it became a game Kaelin wanted to win. Richard never let her win. Not even just to be nice when she was feeling low because of her slow progress at getting stronger. He repeatedly humbled her in front of Kara. Kaelin knew he was doing it to make her push herself to use her muscles. to forget her aches, to stretch and strengthen her body. Kaelin just wanted to win. They each carried their willow switch swords sheathed behind a belt, always at the ready. Every day she would attack him, or he would attack her, and the fight was on. At first she was no challenge to him, and he made it clear she was no challenge. That, of course, only made her determined to show him that she was no novice, and that it was not so much a battle of strength, but of leverage, advantage, and swiftness. He encouraged her, but never gave her false praise. As the weeks passed, she slowly began making him work for his skills. Kaelin had been taught to use a sword by her father, King Wyborn. At least he had been king before Kaelin's mother took him for her mate. King was an insignificant title to a confessor. King Wyborn of Galea had had two children with his queen and first wife, so Kaelin had both an older half-sister and a half-brother. Kaelin wanted very much to make a good show of her training under her father. It was frustrating to know she was far better with a weapon than she was showing Richard. It wasn't so much that she didn't know what to do, but that she simply couldn't do it. Her muscles were not yet strong enough, nor would they respond nearly quickly enough. Something about it, though, was still unsettling. Richard fought in a way Kaelin had never encountered in her training, nor in the real combat she had seen. She couldn't define or analyze the difference, but she could feel it, and she didn't know what to do to counter it. In the beginning, Richard and Kaelin had most of their battles in the meadow outside their house, so that Kaelin wouldn't be as likely to trip over something, and if she did, not as likely to hit her head on anything granite. Kara was their ever-present audience. As time passed, the battles lasted longer and grew more strenuous. They became furious and exhausting. A couple of times Kaelin had been so upset by Richard's relentless attitude toward their sword fights that she didn't speak to him for hours afterward, lest she let slip words she didn't really mean and which she knew she would regret. Richard would then sometimes tell her, "Save your anger for the enemy. Here it will do you no good. There it can overcome fear. Use this time now to teach your sword what to do, so later it will do it without conscious thought." Kaelin well knew that an enemy was never kind. If Richard gave in to kindness, awarded her false pride, it could only serve her ill. As aggravating as such lessons sometimes were, it was impossible to remain angry with Richard for very long, especially because she knew she was really only angry with herself. Kaelin had been around weapons and men who used them all her life. A few of the better ones, in addition to her father, were on occasion her teachers. None of them had fought like Richard. Richard made fighting with a blade look like art. He gave beauty to the act of dealing death. There was something about it, though, tickling at her, something she knew she still wasn't grasping. Richard had told her once before she had been hurt that he had come to believe that magic itself could be an art form. She had told him she thought that was crazy. Now she didn't know. From the bits of the story she'd heard, she suspected that Richard had used magic in something of that way to defeat the chimes. He had created a solution where it had never before existed, nor even been imagined. One day, in one of their fierce sword fights, she had been positive she had him dead to rights, and that she was delivering the stroke of victory. He effortlessly evaded what she had been sure was her killing strike, and killed her instead. He made what had seemed impossible look natural. It was in that instant that the whole concept came clear for her. She had been looking at it all wrong. It wasn't that Richard could fight well with a sword, or that he could create beautiful statues with a knife and chisel. It was that Richard was one with the blade in any form, sword, knife, chisel, or willow switch. He was a master, not of sword fighting or carving as such, but in the most fundamental way, of the blade itself. Fighting was but one use of a blade. His balance for using his sword to destroy, magic always sought balance, was using a blade to carve things of beauty. She had been looking at the individual parts of what he did, trying to understand them separately. Richard saw only one unified whole. Everything about him, the way he shot an arrow, the way he carved, the way he used a sword, even the way he walked with such fluid, reasoned intent, they weren't separate things, separate abilities. They were all the same thing. Richard paused. "What's the matter? Your face is turning white." Kaylin stood with her willow sword lowered. "You're dancing with death. That's what you're doing with your sword." Richard blinked at her, as if she had just announced that rain was wet. "But of course." Richard touched the amulet hanging at his chest. In the center, surrounded by a complex of gold and silver lines, was a teardrop-shaped ruby as big as her thumbnail. "I told you that a long time ago. Are you just now coming to believe me?" She stood gaping. "Yes, I think I am." Kaylin recalled all too clearly his chilling words to her when she had first seen the amulet around his neck, and she had asked him what it was. "The ruby is meant to represent a drop of blood. It is the symbolic representation of the way of the primary edict. It means only one thing and everything. Cut. Once committed to fight, cut. Everything else is secondary. Cut. That is your duty, your purpose, your hunger. There is no rule more important, no commitment that overrides that one. Cut. The lines are a portrayal of the dance. Cut from the void, not from bewilderment. Cut the enemy as quickly and directly as possible. Cut with certainty. Cut decisively, resolutely. Cut into his strength. Flow through the gaps in his guard. Cut him. Cut him down utterly. Don't allow him a breath. Crush him. Cut him without mercy to the depths of his spirit. It is the balance to life, death. It is the dance with death. It is the law a war wizard lives by, or he dies. The dance was art. It was no different, really, from carving. Art expressed through a blade. It was all one and the same to him. He saw no distinction, for within him there was none. They shared the meadow with a red fox who hunted it for rodents mostly, but wasn't averse to chewing on whatever juicy bugs she could catch there. Their horses didn't mind the fox so much, but they didn't like the coyotes that sometimes visited. Kaylin rarely saw them, but she knew they were about when the horses snorted their displeasure. She often heard the coyotes barking at night, higher up in the surrounding slopes. They would let out long, flat howls followed by a series of yips. Some nights the wolves sang their long, monotone howls without the yapping of the coyotes echoing through the mountains. Once Kaylin saw a black bear off in the trees, ambling along, giving them only a passing look, and once a bobcat passed near their house, sending the horses off in a panic. It took Richard the better part of a day to find the horses. Chipmunks begged at their door and regularly invited themselves into the house for a look around. Kaylin often caught herself talking to them and asking questions as if they could understand her every word. The way they paused and cocked their heads at her made her suspect they really could. In the early mornings, small herds of deer often visited the meadow, some leaving fresh, inverted heart-shaped tracks near the door as they passed. Lately, aggressive bucks in rut, bearing huge racks, had been showing up. One of the hides Kaylin wore was from a wolf injured by one of those bucks up in an oak grove not far away. Richard had spared the wounded animal a lingering, suffering death. Beside the sword fights, they went on marches up into the mountains to help Kaylin strengthen her limbs. Those walks were taxing on her leg muscles, sometimes leaving her so sore she couldn't sleep. Richard would rub oil into her feet, calves, and thighs when they hurt too much for her to sleep. That usually worked, relaxing her and making her drowsy and able to fall asleep. She distinctly remembered the rainy night after walking home in the wet and cold, when she lay on her back in bed, eyes shut, as Richard rubbed warm oil into her leg muscles. He whispered that her legs finally seemed to have gotten back all their tone and shape. Kaelin looked up and saw desire in his eyes. It was an almost forgotten thrill to know his hunger for her. She had been so startled that she felt tears trickle down her cheeks with the joy of suddenly feeling like a woman again, a desirable woman. Richard raised her leg to his mouth and gently kissed her bare ankle. By the time his soft, warm kisses reached her thighs, she was panting with suddenly and unexpectedly awakened desire. He laid open her nightshirt and rubbed the warm oil on her exposed belly. His big hands moved up her body to caress her breasts. He breathed through his mouth as he rolled her nipples until they were hard between his finger and thumb. "Why, Lord Rahl," she said in a breathy whisper, "I do believe you are going to get carried away." He paused, seeming to check himself and what he was doing, and then pull back. "I won't break, Richard," she said as she caught his hand and pulled it back. "I'm all right now. I'd like it if you got carried away." She clutched his hair in her fists as his kisses covered her breasts, and then her shoulders, and then worked up her neck. His panting warmed her ear. His exploring fingers made her frantic with need. His body against hers felt wildly erotic. She no longer felt weary. Finally, he tenderly kissed her lips. She let him know by the way she returned the kiss that he needn't be all that tender. As the rain drummed on the roof, lightning lit the lions and the clenched fist strength of the statue in the window, and thunder rumbled through the mountains. Kaelin, without fearing it, without worrying about it, without wondering if she would be able, held Richard tightly as they made quiet, gentle, fierce love. They had never needed each other as much as that night. All her fears and worries evaporated in the heat of overpowering need welling up through her. She wept with the strength of her pleasure and the release of her emotions. When later Richard lay in her arms, she felt a tear roll off his face, and she asked him if something was wrong. He shook his head and said distantly that he had for so long feared losing her that sometimes he had believed he might go mad. It seemed as if he could finally allow himself release from his private terror. The pain Kaelin had first seen in his eyes when she couldn't remember his name was at last banished. Their marches into the mountains ranged farther and farther. Sometimes they took packs and spent the night in the woods, often in a wayward pine, when they could find one. The rugged terrain offered a never-ending variety of vistas. In places, sheer rock cliffs towered over them. In other places, they stood at the brink of sheer drops and watched the sun turn the sky orange and purple as it went down while wispy clouds drifted through quiet green valleys below. They went to towering waterfalls with their own rainbows. There were clear, sunlit pools up in the mountains where they swam. They ate on rocks overlooking rugged sights no one but they ever saw. They followed animal trails through vast woods of gnarled trees, and others among the dark forest floor, where grew trees with trunks like huge brown columns, so big 20 men couldn't have joined hands around them. Richard had Kaelin practice with a bow to help strengthen her arms. They hunted small game for stews or for roasting. Some they smoked and dried along with the fish they caught. Richard usually didn't eat meat, but occasionally he did. Not eating meat was part of the balance needed by his gift for when he was forced to kill. That need of balance was lessening because he wasn't killing. He was at peace. Perhaps the balance was now being served by his carving. As time passed, he was able to eat more meat. When they were out on journeys, they usually ate rice and beans along with bannock and any berries they collected along the way, in addition to game they caught. Kaelin helped clean fish and salt them down and smoke yet others for their winter stores. It was a job that she had never before undertaken. They collected berries, nuts, and wild apples, and put a lot of those away in the root cellar along with root crops he had purchased before coming up into the mountains. Richard dug up small apple trees, when he found any, and planted them in the meadow close by the house so that, he said, some day they would have apples close at hand. Kaelin wondered how long he intended to keep them away from where they were needed. The silent question always hung there, seen by all but unspoken. Kara never asked him, but she sometimes made some small mention of it to Kaelin when they were alone. She was Lord Rahl's guard and glad to be close at hand, so she generally offered no objection. He was, after all, Lord Rahl, and he was safe. Kaelin had always felt the weight of their responsibilities. Like the towering mountains all around, looming over them, always shadowing them, that responsibility could never be completely forgotten. As much as she loved the house Richard had built on the edge of the meadow, and as much as she loved exploring the rugged, beautiful, imposing, and ever-changing mountains, with each passing day she more and more felt that weight, and the anxious need to be back where they were needed most. She fretted at what could be going on that they weren't aware of. The Imperial Order was not going to stay put. An army that size liked to move. Soldiers, especially soldiers of that ilk, became restless in long encampments, and sooner or later started causing trouble. She worried about all the people who needed the reassurance of Richard's presence, his guidance, and hers. There were people who their whole lives had depended on the Mother Confessor always being there to stand up for them. With winter coming on, Richard had made Kaelin a warm mantle, mostly out of wolf fur. The other two pelts were coyotes. Richard had found one of the coyotes with a broken leg, probably from a fall, and had put it out of its misery. The other had been a rogue chased off by the local pack. It had taken to raiding food from the little smokehouse. Richard had taken the sly looter with a single arrow. They had collected most of the wolf pelts from injured or old animals. Richard, Kaelin, and Kara often tracked wolf packs as a way of helping to build Kaelin's strength. Kaelin came to recognize their tracks and even learned to know at a glance if the prints were in mud or soft dirt, their front paws from the rear. Richard showed her how the toes of the front spread out more, with a more well-defined heel pad than the rear paw. He had located several packs in the mountains, and the three of them often followed one group or family to see if they could do so without the wolves knowing. Richard said it was a kind of game guides used to play to keep in practice, to keep their senses sharp. After Kaelin's mantle was completed, they had turned to collecting pelts for Kara's winter fur. Kara, who always wore the clothes of her profession, had liked the idea of Lord Rahl making something for her to wear, the same as he had made for Kaelin. While she had never said as much, Kaelin had always felt that Kara saw the mantle he was making for her as a mark of his feelings, his respect, proof that she was more than just his bodyguard. This had been a journey to find pelts for Kara's mantle, and she had been eager. She had even cooked for them. Now, coming down off the ridge where Kaelin had finally bested Richard in a sword fight, Kaelin was in a good mood. For the last 2 days they had been following the wolf pack up in the mountains to the west of their house. It was not simply a hunt, and not simply to get a pelt for Kara, but part of the never-ending pressure Richard put on Kaelin to keep up. Almost every day for the last 2 months, Richard had her marching over the most difficult terrain, the kind of terrain that made her strain every muscle in her body. As Kaelin had gotten stronger, the marches had gotten longer. At first they were only across the house, now they were across mountains. On top of that, he frequently attacked her with his willow sword and poked fun at her if she didn't put in her absolute hardest fight. In a way, finally beating Richard in one of their mock sword fights puzzled her. He might have been tired from carrying the heaviest pack and scouting some of the steeper trails by himself first and then coming back for them, but he hadn't slacked off, and she had still killed him. She couldn't help but be pleased with herself, even if she did question her victory. Out of the corner of her eye, she had caught him smiling as he looked at her. Kaelin knew Richard was proud of her for besting him. In a way, his losing was a victory for him. Kaelin thought she must be stronger now, after all Richard had put her through, than at any time in her life. It had not been easy, but it had been worth at last feeling like the carving in the window of her bedroom. Kaelin put a hand on Richard's shoulder as he followed Kara down broken granite blocks, placed by chance like big irregular steps. "Richard, how did I beat you?" He saw in her eyes the seriousness of the question. "You killed me because I made a mistake." A mistake? You mean perhaps you had gotten too confident? Perhaps you were just tired or were thinking of something else? Doesn't really matter, does it? Whatever it was a mistake that cost me my life in the game. In a real fight, I would have died. You've taught me a valuable lesson to redouble my resolve, to always put in my absolute full effort. It just goes to remind me, though, that I could make a mistake at any time and lose. Kalin couldn't help but to be struck by the obvious question. Was he making a mistake in staying out of the effort to keep the Midlands free from the tyranny of the Imperial Order? She couldn't help feeling the pull to help her people, even though Richard still felt that if the people didn't want his leadership, his efforts could do no good. As Mother Confessor, Kalin knew that while people didn't always understand that what a leader did was done in their best interest, that was no reason to abandon them. With winter coming on, she hoped the Imperial Order would choose to stay put in Andrith. Kalin needed to convince Richard to return to help the Midlands, but she was at a loss to know how. He was firm in his reasoning, and she could find no chink in the armor of his logic. Emotion did not sway him in this. Kara led them down the craggy precipice, having to backtrack only twice. It was a difficult descent. Kara was pleased with herself and that Richard had let her pick the route. It was her pelt they were going after, so he let her lead them across the tangle of undergrowth in the ravine at the bottom, and then up the following lip of the notch where trees clung with roots like talons to the rocky rise. The wind coming up the ravine had turned bitter. The clouds had thickened until they snuffed out the golden rays of sunlight. Their ascent took them up into a gloomy, dark wood of towering evergreens. Far over their heads, the treetops swayed in the wind, but down on the ground it was still. Their footfalls were hushed by a thick, spongy mat of brown needles. The climb was steep, but not arduous. As they ascended, the big trees grew farther and farther apart. The boughs became scraggly, allowing more of the somber light to seep in. For the most part, the rocks higher up were bare of moss and leaves. In places, they had to use handholds on the rock, or else roots to help them climb. Kalin pulled deep breaths of the cold air. It felt good to test her muscles. They came out of the forest into the steel-gray light of late afternoon and the moaning voice of the wind. They were in the crooked wood. The scree and rock were naked of the thick moss common lower down the mountain, but they bore yellow-green splotches of lichen outlined in black. Only a bit of scraggly brush clung to the low places here and there, but it was the trees that were the most odd and gave the place at the top of the tree line its name. They were all stunted, few taller than Kalin or Richard. Most of the branches grew to one side because of the prevailing winds, leaving the trees looking like grotesque running skeletons frozen in torment. Above the crooked wood, few things other than sedges and lichens grew. Above that, the snow cap held sway. "Here it is," Kara said. They found the wolf sprawled on the scree beside a low boulder with a dark stain of dried blood at the sharp edge. Up higher, the pack of gray wolves had been trying to take down a woodland caribou. The old bull had grazed the unlucky wolf with a kick. That in itself would likely not have been anything more than painful, but the wolf had slipped from the higher ledge and fallen to its death. Kalin ran her fingers through the thick yellow-gray coat tipped in black. It was in good condition, and would be a warm addition to Kara's winter mantle. Richard and Kara started skinning the good-sized female animal as Kalin went out to the edge of an overhang. She drew her own mantle up around her ears as she stood in the bitter wind, surveying the approaching clouds. She was somewhat startled by what she saw. "Richard, it's not drizzle coming our way," Kalin said. "It's snow." He looked up from his bloody work. "Do you see any wayward pines down in the valley?" She squinted down to the valley floor spread out before her. "Yes, I see a couple. The snow is still a ways off. If you're not long at that, we can probably make it down there and collect some wood before it gets wet." "We're almost done," Kara said. Richard stood to have a quick look for himself. With a bloody hand, he absently lifted his real sword a few inches and then let it drop back. a habit he had of checking to make sure the weapon was clear in its scabbard. It was an unsettling gesture. He had not drawn the weapon from its hilt since the day he'd been forced to kill all those men who had attacked them back near Heartland. Is something wrong? What? Richard saw where her eyes were looking and glanced down at the sword on his hip. Oh, no, nothing, just habit, I guess. Kaelin pointed. There's a wayward pine there. It's the closest and good size, too. Richard wiped the back of his wrist across his brow, swiping his hair away from his eyes. His fingers glistened with blood. We'll be down there sheltered by a wayward pine, sitting beside a cozy fire, having tea before dark. I can stretch the hide on the branches inside and scrape it there. The snow will help insulate us inside the tree's boughs. We'll have a good rest before heading back in the morning. Down a little lower, it will only be rain. Kaelin snuggled her cheek inside her wolf fur as a shiver tingled through her shoulders and up the back of her neck. Winter had snuck up on them. Chapter 20. When they arrived home 2 days later, the little fish in the jars were all dead. They had used the same easier route over the pass that they had originally used to enter the valley when they had first come in with the horses months before. Of course, Kaelin didn't recall that trip. She had been unconscious. It seemed a lifetime ago. There was now a shorter trail to their home, one they had blazed down from the pass. They could have used that alternate route, but it was narrow and difficult, and would have saved them only 10 or 15 minutes. They had been out for days, and as they had wearily stood in the windswept notch at the top of the pass, looking down at their cozy home far below at the edge of the meadow, they had decided to take the easier passage, even though it took a little longer. It had been a relief to finally get inside the house, out of the wind, and drop all their gear. As Richard brought in firewood and Kara fetched water, Kaelin pulled out a little square of cloth with some small bugs she had caught earlier that day, intending to give her fish a treat, since they were sure to be hungry. She let out a little groan when she saw that they were dead. "What's the matter?" Kara asked as she walked in, lugging a full bucket. She came over to see the fish. "Looks like they starved," Kaelin told her. "Little fish like that don't often live long in a jar," Richard said as he knelt and started stacking birch logs atop kindling in the fireplace. "But they did live a long time," Kaelin said, as if to prove him wrong and somehow talk him out of it. "You didn't name them, did you? I told you not to name them because they would die after a time. I warned you not to let yourself get emotionally attached when it can only come to no good end." Kara named one. "Did not," Kara protested. "I was just trying to show you which one I was talking about, that's all." After the flames took from his flint, Richard looked up and smiled. "Well, I'll get you some more." Kaelin yawned. "But these were the best ones. They needed me." Richard snorted a laugh. "You've got quite the imagination. They only depended on us because we artificially altered their lives. Just like the chipmunks would stop hunting seeds for their winter stores if we gave them handouts all the time. Of course, the fish had no choice because we kept them in jars. Left to their own initiative, the fish wouldn't need any help from us. After all, it took a net to catch them. I'll catch you some more, and they'll come to need you just as much."
This is the end of Side 1. This program is continued on Side 2 of this cassette.